A news story reports that George and Leslie Brock had been spending a day at the beach December 28th in South Florida when they stopped at a diner for a bite. George was about halfway through a $10 plate of steamed clams when he chomped down on something hard. He spat out the lump and found a rare iridescent purple pearl about 6 millimeters across. Their find could be worth thousands. As if that weren't unusual enough, his wife Leslie noted, the funny part of it is he hardly ever orders clams. What was initially an alarming event, biting down on something unexpectedly hard, turned out to be a real blessing, a pearl of great price. How clams form pearls can actually be an analogy for troubles that turn into treasures. When a clam gets a bit of sharp sand or stone inside, at first it's an irritant to the soft-bodied mollusks. But the clam sets to work secreting a special substance to coat the irritant. After a while, what was just a bit of grit, an annoyance or hindrance, has been transformed into an object of true beauty and great value. The story of Ruth, Boaz, and Naomi is a bit like that. The first bites of life were pretty hard for poor Naomi. But the Lord's help and the care of friends surrounded the trials with his grace and mercy, bringing treasure out of tragedy. Why would we even consider spending a few weeks on the book of Ruth? Doesn't it seem pretty small, insignificant, and far removed? True, it does originate in a very distant time and culture with social dynamics much different from our own. The very first verse says it happened in the days when the judges ruled. This would put it somewhere in the range from 1380 to 1050 BC, over 3,000 years ago. It was a very dark time morally for Israel. They were politically fragile, hardly a country yet, more an association of a dozen tribes from the same family. Everyone is scrambling just to survive. It would be centuries yet until Israel's golden era under King David and then Solomon. This book comes from a very long time ago. The picture there is the fields around Bethlehem. Yet the book of Ruth has a widespread, almost universal appeal. Compared to the surrounding historical books of the Old Testament, this one has the feel of kind of a homey narrative or novel. It's a story told from an everyday perspective that the common person, the working man or woman, can relate to. It offers a delightful glimpse into social customs of the time on a community level. You sort of sense you're walking back in time through one of those pioneer villages, way back in time, watching people harvest in the field, party when the work's done, and then conduct legal transactions at an outdoor court. The short novella, if we can call it that, features some stellar characters. Ruth, the younger woman, so sacrificial and devoted. Boaz, the most marriageable middle-aged bachelor in the countryside, full of kindness and consideration. And Naomi, the senior citizen with wizened face and heavy heart, yet who displays remarkable faith, realism, and shrewd elderly guidance. The book's also a charmer because, well, face it, it involves a romance. All the ladies will be getting excited. While there's an element that's slightly risque, yet the heroes come out upholding moral integrity. We need good moral examples in today's world. People who don't cave in when tempted. We watched the end of Napoleon Dynamite on the Much Channel last night, and then they had the Much Newsmakers of 2007 and the top 10. And what a sorry lot, really, all these stars and celebrities, people that overdosing, and really, who would... also, they said this was the year for stars that got charged drinking under the driving under the influence, DUIs, there's several of them, too. And custody battles and all, just what a mess. Britney Spears may be kind of an icon, but who would really want her for a mother? So we need good moral examples, and this book has them. Another reason the book of Ruth is good to review right now is the high level of immigration in many countries in the world, with the risk of resulting racism. I heard it reported that the population of the Netherlands is now officially one-third Muslim. Christian Week reports that the school board in Quebec with the most people in Montreal has 106,000 students, of which 23%, that's nearly a quarter, are immigrants from 193 different countries belonging to a vast array of religious persuasions. That's a pile of diversity. It takes some adjusting to get along with our new neighbors and not become racist. They're so different. Pluralism tempts us to become tribal and prejudiced in outlook. The story of Ruth reminds us God's kingdom has believers from all kinds of backgrounds. Also, we're entering a new year. It's good to be able to look back and, where needed, acknowledge the hardship of existence, the strength found in community and relationship, especially God's grace in turning around lives and circumstances for a fresh start. For all these reasons, Ruth's a real gem of a book to study. If 2007 was a particularly hard year for you, you've come to the right place. You're about to meet Naomi, a woman who knows all about hardship to the nth degree. The overall theme of the book deals with how her bad news got resolved, how God restored her fortunes. Naomi sums up her descent well in verse 21. She says, "I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty." Feel like you're kind of running on empty. People throughout the centuries in the Judeo-Christian stream and otherwise have struggled to explain why life can be so tragic at times. Pagan philosophers came up with the concept of blind fate. The Roman poet Boethius suggested the idea of a goddess turning a wheel of fortune, no connection to the game show. Boethius wrote in translation, "With domineering hand she moves the turning wheel, like currents in a treacherous bay swept to and fro. Her ruthless will has just deposed once fearful kings, while trustless still from low she lifts a conquered head. No cries of misery she hears, no tears she heeds, but steely-hearted laughs at groans her deeds have wrung. Such is a game she plays, and so she tests her strength. Of mighty power she makes parade when one short hour sees happiness from utter desolation grow." End quote. That's the way Boethius kind of pictured this woman with the wheel of fortune. Notice the adjectives describing this pagan embodiment of blind fate: treacherous, ruthless, trustless, steely-hearted. Such a contrast to the biblical picture of God, abounding in covenant love, faithful, just, and righteous. Yet Boethius' writings influenced the medieval and Renaissance era, Chaucer, Dante, Machiavelli, and then Shakespeare. You may have studied in school, I know I did, the Wheel of Fate in connection with Shakespeare's works. He wrote of "Giddy fortune's furious fickle wheel, that goddess blind that stands upon the rolling restless stone." That's Henry V. So it's Shakespeare taking this idea of blind fate. The first five verses of the book of Ruth would classify as quite a sudden downturn in literature's wheel of fate. So this would actually classify as a comedy when it turns out okay, right? These 71 words in Hebrew are balanced at the end, and chapter 4, by exactly 71 words describing Naomi's restored fortunes. Now, it's a real literary work of art. This doesn't come through in English because this is back in the Hebrew. They're counting the words in that. The middle verse, 220, marks a crucial turning point. So whoever is writing this has structured it very artistically in a balanced way. Anyway, enough of the English lecture. What exactly are the stages in the tragic portion of Naomi's story? First, in verse 1, there was a famine in the land of Israel. No food in Bethlehem, which is supposed to mean house of bread. A second loss occurs when they leave their homeland and emigrate to Moab in hopes of finding food. And to verse 2, a Moab at this period was quite a despised, oppressive enemy. They drew the Israelites into idolatry before crossing the Jordan on the exodus from Egypt. During the time of the judges, they conquered sections of Israel, kind of wiping out entire villages and imposing heavy tribute. So the Israelites didn't like the Moabites. There's kind of real rivalry there. Not to mention Lot's begetting of their ancestor by incest. Moab literally means of his or her father, You look back to Genesis 19 for that kind of sordid tale. That's after Lot's wife turned into a pillar of salt. Third, in verse 3, Naomi's husband Elimelech dies. As if that weren't bad enough, after about 10 years, in verse 5, her two sons died. One's name Mahlon means sickly, so he may have had poor health all along. The name of the other, Chilion, means pining. Was there some other misfortune in their background that would prompt the parents to give him a name like that? Pining? You come here, pining. You kind of got to wonder. What else had Naomi and Elimelech been pining about that isn't mentioned? So when we pick up the narrative, there's been a lot of stress and loss in Naomi's life, much more than most people encounter in their lifetime. She's left on her own, deprived of the life of her husband and her two sons. Don't forget that this isn't 21st century Canada. It's an ancient agrarian patriarchal society, bare minimum social structure in a loose confederacy, frequently prone to enemy raiders. No health care, no pension, no social assistance. She faced the prospect of being destitute without a breadwinner or an heir. Begging and homelessness loomed ahead for a bereft single widow. Naomi's life was largely spent. She may have felt she had nothing left to really attract anyone's interest. Such devastation. What's Naomi to do with all this? Well, the shocks might send some people into a blue fog, a depression, but Naomi copes remarkably well. Her faith in God is no doubt a factor. For one thing, she's realistic, accepting the facts, acknowledging the loss. Second half of verse 13, she says, "It's more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." Verses 20 to 21, she's very descriptive, telling the people who used to know her not to call her Naomi, which means pleasant, anymore, instead to call her Mara, which means bitter. "Because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." NLT translates that last part. "The Lord has caused me to suffer. The Almighty has sent such tragedy upon me." So she's realistic. She can call it for what it is, acknowledging her loss. See, you can be honest with God. Although her situation is bitter, not pleasant, Naomi doesn't let herself sink into lasting bitterness. Along with being realistic, she is still relying on God rather than blaming her misfortune on some fickle, blind fate. Throughout what she says, you catch the implication that she still views the Lord Yahweh as sovereign. He's responsible and still capable of blessing those who trust in him. Now, most people who'd lost the male supporters in the family would be only too glad to have a couple of strong young women to help look after her. But in verse 8, Naomi surprisingly releases Orpah and Ruth rather than controlling or kind of taking advantage of them. She urges them repeatedly, "Go back to your mother's home." Because she's relying on God, she doesn't need or want to drag them down with her into poverty. Look at the word she uses as a blessing. "May the Lord show kindness to you. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Now, if Naomi were really mad at God, really bitter for the deaths that he'd allowed to happen, I don't think she'd use his name in a blessing. It's a bad time she's going through, a devastating time, in fact, but she's still leaning on God to bless and redeem. That gives her grace to grant Orpah and Ruth their freedom. She gives them a choice. Are you able to trust God and refer to him even when you're going through tough times? Can you resist the temptation to turn your back on him and not have anything more to do with the one who has caused such suffering? Years hence, Naomi's great-great-grandson, David, would also go through a harrowing experience when Absalom usurped the throne and David, the great king, was forced to flee. But even then, David kept trusting God to bring about what was good and right in the long run. He said in 2 Samuel 15, "But if God says, 'I am pleased with you,' then I am ready." If God says, I am not pleased with you, then I am ready. Let him do to me whatever seems good to him. That's faith. In 1963, Mary Kay Ash and her husband invested their life savings in Mary Kay Cosmetics. Anybody here bought Mary Kay Cosmetics at one time or another? Probably. Yeah, okay, quite a few. You know who I'm talking about. A month later, her husband died, and she was told by her attorney and other advisors to liquidate the company in hopes of salvaging some of her investment. Instead of quitting, she pressed on. Later, her accountant told her that she paid too much commission and that she couldn't succeed without reducing her pay scale. Again, she ignored the advice and eventually built one of America's largest cosmetic companies. Now, Naomi's story might have remained a tragedy, except that God has already provided two remarkable people to enter Naomi's life, Ruth, her daughter-in-law, and Boaz, whom we'll meet in chapter 2. Ruth's name appropriately means friend. She comes alongside to help in time of need, much as does the Holy Spirit, our paraclete. Ruth is also one of just four women who are named in Jesus' genealogy in Matthew 1. Exceptional women in Jesus' family tree, including Tamar, Rahab, and Bathsheba. Easton's dictionary notes Ruth as a woman characterized by unselfishness, brave love, and unshaken trustfulness. Now, Ruth has a foil or counter character in Orpah, who highlights Ruth's strengths by her different actions. Both Ruth and Orpah are dealing with their own grief. Their husbands died, just as Naomi's did. Yet both are young enough to make a go of it on their own, start over again with another man, unlike aging Naomi. Both Ruth and Orpah are raised under teaching about the pagan Moabite god Chemosh. This idol was depicted as a destroyer and a subduer, demanding human sacrifice. At one point, the Moabite king sacrifices his eldest son to stave off an Israelite attack. 2 Kings 3. Both Ruth and Orpah responded initially to Naomi's dismissing of them by saying they would return with her to Israel. But after Naomi really spells out the consequences of a decision to go to Israel, that she really had nothing to offer, Orpah turned back to remain in Moab. Verse 14. At this they wept again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye. But Ruth clung to her. Living translates, Ruth clung tightly to her. A third time, Naomi dismisses her, as if Ruth still hasn't gotten the message. This is going to be really tough. You don't want to go here. But this only draws out a beautiful declaration of commitment, often used in weddings to this day. A totally unconditional, no-holds-barred dedication of enduring love that's poetic, strong, and immortal. Verses 16 and 17, Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I'll be buried." Then to underline her seriousness, she uses a standard binding oath formula. "May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." Wow. What a declaration of attachment. You're not shaking me no matter how hard you try, how tough the going gets. Repetition makes it especially eloquent. Go, go, stay, stay, people, God. And then the promise that nothing less than death would separate them. How our marriages need that kind of stick-to-itiveness today. Ruth's powerful promise to Naomi echoes God's pledge of unconditional love for us and commitment to us as his people. On the inside of my wedding ring here is inscribed Deuteronomy 31:8. "The Lord is the one who goes ahead of you. He will be with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. Do not fear or be dismayed." Jesus promised something similar to his disciples on a couple of occasions. At the end of Great Commission in Matthew 28, he promises, "And surely I am with you always, even to the end of the age." In John 14, he said, "I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you." He's not going to run out on us, desert us, or abandon us. Like Ruth, even more so, he is a forever friend. I'm going to be there for you all the way. That's what friends do. Not Chemosh style, but Christ style. Often in Scripture we find God's concern expressed for widows and orphans, foreigners and the poor. Ruth just happens to be the incarnated expression of God's tangible love for Naomi, making all the difference in the situation. Ruth's name means friend. She expresses that beautifully. Someone has said a friend has been defined as the first person who comes in when the whole world has gone out. Must have seemed to Naomi that the world had dropped out from under her feet, but Ruth remained there at her side to bolster and support her. Before my closing illustration, I would say the two neighbor boys across the road from us, Jeff and Daniel, were friends this past week. It was Wednesday morning when the temperature was so cold, the driveway needed clearing so Meredith and her friend from Alberta could go out, and I couldn't get the tractor with the snowblower to start. While I was working away fiddling with a fuel line trying to get it to go, Jeff and Daniel finished their own driveway and they just kind of came across the road and started on mine. I thanked them and told them that was okay, I could do it myself. You know, I got this big machine here and all that. Yeah, they kept on clearing while I kept on tinkering. I never did get it going that day. Eventually I grabbed a shovel and helped them finish the last few strips. Good for me that they were better at showing practical friendship than I was at fixing. A new homeowner's riding lawnmower had broken down and he was been trying, working fruitlessly for 2 hours trying to get it back together. Suddenly, one of his neighbors appeared with a handful of tools. He asked, "Can I give some help?" In 20 minutes, he had the mower functioning beautifully. "Thanks a million," the now happy newcomer said. "And say, what do you make with such fine tools?" The neighbor smiled and answered, "Mostly friends. I'm available anytime." Let's pray.